Andrew Ford writes music, and Ben Quilty is an award-winning painter. And apart from being talented, arty blokes, they just happen to be neighbours. What are the odds of having so much talent concentrated in one tiny green hamlet in the Southern Highlands of New South Wales? Ben and Andy both agree that art and music are all about context. Knowing the history of your art form is essential, so you know when to ignore it. In this final conversation between them about creativity, Andrew describes the nerve-wracking experience of hearing his symphony performed alongside Beethoven's Fifth. Yikes! While Ben celebrates curatorial practice that places emerging artists alongside the masters. Today, they're in Andy's studio talking about the weight of tradition.
I'm Andrew Ford. I'm a composer, and this is some of my music. It's called Hymn to the Sun. It's based on a piece by Mesomedes of Crete from around the year 140.
Ben.
Hello, mate.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. It's cold. It's
my neighbour in the New South Wales countryside is the painter Ben Quilty, and some mornings he comes down the hill to my place for coffee.
Finally, this town needs this cold weather.
Yeah, come in. We've got a new coffee machine. I don't know how it works.
I know.
Quite often, we end up talking about art and music of the past.
Would you like a coffee?
Yes, please. I'd love one.
All right.
So, Andy, when I think of the way we are creative and what it means to be creative, I always think back to when I was a little tiny child and those first inspirations. Do you remember your first feeling of inspiration? What first drove you to music?
I remember as a child, there was a piano at my grandparents, my father's parents, and we used to go and visit them. And there was a piano in the front parlour in this tiny two up, two down terraced house in Liverpool in what was frankly a slum, although a very clean slum.
But who played the piano?
No one. I don't know why it was there. I think it was just like, you know, I mean, these were people who were born in the 19th century and I think people just had pianos.
To put vases on.
Yes, that's right. I mean, no one even used the room. Given that they only had two up and two down, the front parlour was kept for some special occasion, you know, like a royal visit.
We never know. You need to be prepared.
Anyway, I would go in there. And, of course, the piano was incredibly out of tune, I now realise, because when I hear an out-of-tune piano, a badly out-of-tune piano, I remember theirs. So it must have been. And I remember I played it a lot. I mean, I banged on it. I made things up. And I remember going into the back parlour and saying to my parents and my grandparents, I'm going to play a piece called The Animals in the Jungle. And then I went back into the piano and I performed.
How old were you?
I don't know.
A little.
Young, very young. Sort of 4 or 5, I expect. Something like that. And I performed this piece called The Animals in the Jungle. So the notion of making a piece of music was there then. But I was nobody's prodigy. I started writing music down, very much inspired by some pieces of Stockhausen, particularly, that I heard in the early 1970s. So I would have been in my mid-teens by then. And even then, I went to university to do English, not music. But I had to do music in my first year. Everybody had to do 3 subjects. Music was one of them. And I was composing, and I was working with a composition teacher called Edward Cowie, who was in Australia for a time. And at the end of my first year, he said, I think, Andy, you might be a composer. And I think that moment was really important. And I don't know whether you had a moment like that, but you know, composing music is such a weird thing, even compared to painting, because most people can draw a bit. You know, most people draw, if only to draw a diagram or a map to show somebody how to get somewhere. I mean, we all draw, but almost nobody composes music. And I felt that, in a sense, he was giving me permission to be a composer, and I think I needed that, and I suspect that most composers do.
Can I take you back to the beginning of that year, the first time you wrote music down? How ambitious were you in visualising, is my word, clearly, but when you visualised the way that would be performed, your first tentative notes that you put down, it's a very abstract thing for me because mine is a line and there it is, it's there, it's visual. But what was your ambitions then for those first notes playing in your mind?
Oh, I just wanted them to sound good, I think. I loved the idea of inventing sound, and I still love the idea of notating it, of finding a way to notate a sound as precisely as possible. Of course, you can't be precise, but one little bit of musical notation can include information about how, well, not just the actual pitch, but how loud the pitch is, how long the pitch is, how the pitch should start, whether there should be an attack on it, you know, an accent, whether it starts quietly and gets louder. It might be if you're writing a note for a violin, you might give some information about which part of the string is bowed, which bit of the bow is used. So all of that, you know, there's notation for all of that. And I find that endlessly fascinating. And my ideal score is one where nobody has to ask any questions. You know, you put the music in front of the players at the first rehearsal and they start rehearsing. Mm. And no one says, excuse me, what does this mean? That everything is in the score. I have had that experience a few times. I've actually where there haven't been any questions at all, but it's pretty hard because usually there are questions.
Mm. Those first 12 months, what instruments were you writing for?
Oh, everything.
Yeah, right from the outset.
Yes, yes, yes. Absolutely.
How many instruments were you playing?
None.
None?
No.
Amazing.
I don't think it is amazing because when you think about
it. It is for me, Andy.
but most composers, you know, composers write for orchestras. Mm. Well, you know, they don't play all of the instruments in an orchestra, so.
But you can hear them.
But you hear them and you know about them and you read about them and you talk to players and you work with players and you discover what sounds good in which part of the instrument and the colours that you can get out of them. So, yes, you store up this information, but most composers have not been great performers, and quite a lot of composers have been no sort of performer. I can think of quite a lot of composers, particularly in the 20th century when composing became a bit more specialist. There have been plenty of composers who really couldn't play their own music, and I'm one of them.
Mm.
But that's tremendously different, isn't it, to being a painter, where obviously you do your own painting.
Look, the notion is so conceptual, so entirely conceptual. But I guess there's that sense that you can hear it, and you must be able to hear it in your head. I only hear voices in my head. it's intriguing, extraordinary.
Given what I said before, that everybody draws, and especially as a child, everybody draws, at what point did you know that it was something more than what every child does?
I remember my mum had a book of Rodin's sculptures and drawings for sculptures on a little book, a little sort of nondescript, mostly black and white book, and it just seemed the most fabulous and foreign thing to see this book. And Mum was always interested. Mum was always printmaking and drawing, and Mum taught me to draw. Look, Mum used to play the piano as well, and I remember her playing thinking, one day I want to be able to do that. It's an extraordinary thing to see your parent do something that's so unattainable when you don't barely have control over your hands and hand-eye coordination's learnt over so many years. But Mum and Dad always said that we always sort of taught us that burning fossil fuels for fun was a dumb idea, and we grew up in a place not unlike the Southern Highlands, and little boys rode motorbikes, or there's no way we were going to do things like that. We were forced into nature and music and theatre and all the rest of all the wonderful things, really. And I think that helps a child build imagination. And then drawing was putting form to your imagination. And I remember very early on sensing that I was beginning to have control over my pencil and feeling that that was a magical thing. But then once you've got it, you take it for granted. Mm-hmm. It's then about using those tools, those skills to describe a concept, which is what you're talking about. But saying that, you say not many people write. Well, not a lot of people become artists either.
No.
And you can draw. Everyone draws, but every child bangs away on pianos too. Mm. And in some sense, I think we underestimate what little children are doing when they're sitting there banging on a piano, having control over a sound that they just, by putting their hands down, have this very manual control over something is profound for a little 3- and 4-year-old.
Yes, I think you're right about small children and musical creativity. I think you're absolutely right, because small children also make up tunes.
Mm.
And I think we tend to dismiss it.
Yep.
I think we tend to sort of beat that out of children, not literally, but, you know, particularly our education system, alas, doesn't really value that sort of activity at all.
Even as adults, we're programmed to find that sound annoying.
Mm.
And little children, I know my children, they're the songs they play on the piano are repetitive and jarring, but it's them learning control over that sound,
yes,
which they can see. They see what it can become. The possibilities are very obvious to children.
Some people find my music jarring.
Yes, sometimes I think you go out of your way to make it jarring, Andy. But, you know, I think given that little bit of freedom, maybe even soundproofing a room so that the piano's away from you if you need to, for the children to really bash away on it, and my children have been, whether they become following your footsteps remains to be seen, Andy. And, well, you, Andy, back to you, I mean, music's the same, it follows traditions, and contemporary music, I always find the best contemporary music is very difficult to get into, and you'll have to learn it. People will give me something and say, what do you think of this, whether it's music or theatre or visual arts or film, and if it's really cutting edge and breaking new ground, it takes a while to, obviously, you have to relearn a language.
In music, of course, there is all this wealth of great music going back centuries, and if you are successful as a composer and you have your music performed, it's going to be performed from time to time on programs with Beethoven you know, and all of the others, and that puts you in a really interesting position, you know, and apart from anything else, it can seem a bit impertinent.
Yes.
To have your music coming after or just before a piece by Beethoven. Not to mention, actually, my first symphony, my only symphony so far, had its first performance on the same program as Beethoven's Fifth. Which, if I had known that when I was writing my piece, I think I would have been completely constipated, musically speaking. Yes. I mean, what would you do?
Yes.
I suppose your work obviously is in galleries and
Museums is the same.
Museums, yes. I mean, so
look at most great museums around the world show the great masterpieces throughout the ages and contemporary art. And they are all given the opportunity to show alongside the Beethovens of the world, which is exciting. It's dynamic, I think. And things are greatly breaking down now, where people are showing great masterpieces right alongside young contemporary emerging artists from their state. I mean, in Australia, the Art Gallery of South Australia started doing it a few years ago, really just threw the collection on its head, put emerging artists from suburbs in Adelaide alongside the great masters of the early 20th, 19th centuries, from Australian colonial art, you know, right through. I think that's the way things are happening now. In a sense, it's trying to break down that idea of a hierarchy so that there's more opportunity for artists to come in and engage, I think, which needs to happen because there's less and less opportunities, less and less funding, less and less acceptance of what we do, Andy, I think, as capitalism just is slowly swallowing the world, and we need to fight back.
But coming back to great art of the past, do you draw inspiration from it? Do you look at works by Leonardo or whoever it is, Rodin, and find ways of working based on what you've observed there?
I found a massive book of Rodin sculptures at the Kangaroo Valley Markets about 4 years ago, and I can't rip the pages out of the book, although I've wanted to rip the pages out and stick them to the walls. It's the most extraordinary book. It was $5, that book. And that has, in some senses, looking back at those Rodins in black and white, a 60s copy of this book, pushed my whole art practice in a different direction. Really? No doubt about
it. Can you say why?
Because from modernity onwards, there's been this very... And I think it's mirrored in the broader society, this very selfish, inward-looking way of being human that has almost actively disregarded the past as being old-fashioned and quaint. And when I opened that book and looked from one page to the next and thought, there is a genius, there's his fingerprints and his handprints and the pressure that he put from his body onto a piece of clay, which has made these extraordinary objects that will last for time because they're in bronze for all time, and that's exciting. To it's just reinvention. I mean, it's looking back, and Picasso as well. Constantly, there's books I have where there's a reason that he's seen as one of the great visual arts figures of the past 400 years. There's a reason for that.
One of the things I like about looking at a painting, though, and this is certainly true of looking at your paintings, Ben, is in a sense you can I can control it.
Mm.
I can't change anything. I promise you, I don't go up,
with
a little pen knife and kind of
little scrape here.
But, I can walk up to it, I can walk away from it, I can turn away from it and then look back at it. And that, to me, it's like participatory.
Mm.
I can walk out of the room and then I can return. And in the case of your paintings, it's perhaps more extreme that if you stand way back or walk right up to it and put your nose to the painting, I mean, the difference is often huge.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, that's the theatrics of what, for me, making a painting really does involve, and quite often visual artists love to pretend that they're not engaged in this practice, but you're making a work that has that theatrical element of the fact that someone will stand in front of it and they might smell it, they'll definitely see it, and in that sense they'll be feeling it. And I'm always very conscious and aware of the space, hopefully knowing the space that it will be shown in and what the theatrics of the space are, to help the people understand that work. To go back a bit to that you like to see the finger marks of the Rodin, and I was thinking that the Jeff Koons, you know, that there's been artists through the past 30 years where there's no marks. And I think that was very much in a response to the way we're becoming an automated society, and there is this sense of hands off, humans off. But I really feel, and I feel it in music as well, that there's been this resurgence of humans taking back the humanity in the arts. People like Adrian Ghini, who represented Romania in the last Venice Biennale, Cecily Brown, Antony Mikhalev, all these artists around the world who are really engaging in leaving their fingerprints on things to show in centuries to come that we were human, that we do exist, that we want to respond to the world. Do you feel that about music, that music now is digital music and tech?
Yes, absolutely. And I like a sort of pugnaciousness in music. I don't just mean pugnacious music, but if we just going back to the symphony that I wrote that I mentioned before, in that piece there are many sort of rather glacial sounds, but then there are suddenly fierce sounds, you know, where you actually hear the effect of somebody whacking a drum or blowing very hard through a tuba. And it's partly the sheer physicality of the act that I like. There's something thrilling about someone whacking a drum hard. And particularly when it comes after something which is very, very soft. That there is a volatility, I suppose, I hope, in the piece that is as a result of that you're not quite sure when it's next going to explode. But having said that, it is a piece just called Symphony, and if I ever write another one, it'll change its name to Symphony Number 1. But at the moment, it's just called Symphony, and there's no program. There's nothing there. It's not about anything else. It is abstract, and yet it's full of physical sound, an extremely physical sound in some places. So there is a kind of tension, I suppose, between, on the one hand, what would seem to be very human, and on the other hand, you can't pin it down, you can't say what it means.
And in 500 years, the tuba player who has to blast his lungs or her lungs through that tuba will still have to do that same thing, and the laugh will still be on you, Andy. You are making people through the ages do things like that to instruments.
Yes, I suppose so, except that players change over the centuries. And, you know, the famous opening of the Rite of Spring, which is very, very high bassoon. Well, it's not so high anymore. It was very, very high back in 1913 at the first performance. But now the composer Harrison Birtwistle joked that maybe it would be good if the piece was transposed up a semitone every year, just to keep that opening really, really scary for the player. Because that was what Stravinsky had in mind. You know? He wanted this very high sound, which was going to, and there's nothing else playing, there's just that bassoon. And Stravinsky, I'm sure, expected the bassoonist to be terrified, coming in quietly at the beginning with nothing else, very high. And now it's a party piece. So that's an effect that time has on music. And of course, it has that effect on visual arts as well. You know, there are paintings which once shocked audiences, and now you would be hard pressed to say what was shocking about that. It's not just that they don't shock anymore. You can't see why they shocked in the first place.
My little 10-year-old was looking at a Mondrian, the geometry of Mondrian, studying it in year 5 at school. And I could see why that Mondrian was just something that he has seen everywhere on every billboard, on every piece of digital media. It is everywhere now. My little 10-year-old just couldn't get his head around why Mondrian was so important. I said, imagine that Mondrian did that and no one had ever done a grid-like pattern with colours in that sense ever before. In the sense, he then preempted the whole digital era.
But what I love about Mondrian now, and this relates both to the idea of the physical act and the passing of time, is that when you walk up to one of those paintings in a gallery today, there's a sort of patina of cracks across it, and the whites are actually sort of turning cream.
Yeah.
I don't suppose Mondrian himself would have been pleased, but I think that's tremendously powerful.
Mm. Well, in that sense, music stays fresh too.
It can do, yeah. That's right, and it should do.
Yes.
And when you play Beethoven's Fifth Symphony or The Rite of Spring or any other work from the past, famous or not famous, it's your job to make it sound as though it's the first time.
Mm.
And there will always be somebody in the audience for whom it is the first
time. That's right.
That's the thing, the great excitement of attending a concert of a piece that you know backwards and have heard all your life in the company of someone who's never heard it before.
Mm.
And that can be enough to make you hear it with new ears. And, of course, having a child it does that as well, doesn't it?
Well, it's exciting. It can be vicarious for everything.
Yeah.
And no cracks, except for maybe cracks in a broken tuba that someone's blown too hard because of you.
I think we stopped there.
Yeah, that was good.
And that was the last in our series of conversations between Andrew Ford and Ben Quilty, called Three Front Doors and a Paddock, in honour of the distance between their homes in the Southern Highlands of New South Wales. I do hope you enjoyed them. If you missed any, they're all available to listen to online or to download. And there's loads of extra content on our website, Ben's paintings, Andrew's music, so go check it out. While you're there, leave us a comment, or if you really, really liked them, tell a friend about us. Like us on Facebook and give Earshot a big, fat 5-star rating on iTunes. It really does help people find us. This series was produced by Andy Ford, Ben Quilty and Lorena Allam, with sound engineer Mark Don. I'm Kirsty Melville, and I'll catch you next time.